that really it? That was the end of the gospel for this Sunday, Easter Sunday? In case you missed it, I will read once more the last verse of Mark's gospel. So they went out and fled the tomb, for terror and amazement had seized them. And they said nothing to anyone, for they were afraid. So if that's the end of our passage, perhaps it might be helpful to start at the beginning of our story for this morning. This might hopefully, possibly, can help shed some light. Because our story this morning begins in darkness. The darkness of morning, the darkness of morning. It is early, just before the break of day. These women who have followed Jesus for months, maybe even for years, these women who have fed him and the disciples, perhaps clothed him, have given what they have, their resources, for him. They are preparing to visit him one last time. What did those women go there that morning to do? Our gospel passage this morning tells us they were there to anoint his body, essentially to embalm it. But did they go to grieve, perhaps, more closely with his body? Did they go maybe to show him their affection one last time? If you remember, on Friday, Jesus, after he died, because the Sabbath was approaching, well, his body needed to be cared for. And maybe out of fear for who knows what would happen next, or because the Sabbath was so close, Jesus' burial was necessarily brief. Joseph of Arimathea bought a linen cloth, wrapped Jesus' body, and laid it in a tomb, sealing the tomb with a large stone against the door. Painful and incomplete as it was for most others, for the rest of the disciples, the matter was closed, sealed like the tomb. But not for these women. Now, I don't know that it was because they loved Jesus anymore, or because they feared the religious and political authorities any less. But it is clear that they felt compelled to be with Jesus one last time, to prepare his body, to give it the dignity and the attention that had been robbed. Biblical scholar Serene Jones calls us to imagination. Imagination that early morning. Imagine, she writes, imagine the raw determination that must have driven these women there. That time of day, that time in history, in that season of unrelenting violence. Determined to offer their love, come what may. And as they walk through Jerusalem early that sorrowful morning, in the dark, the sun begins to rise. Reader, take note, the sun begins to rise. Upon reaching the tomb, though, they soon run into a problem, but not the problem that they were expecting. They came expecting a large stone to block their entry. They were clearly worrying about it on their way. Our text then reads, but when they looked up, reader, take note, they were looking down. Why would they be looking down? My own sense is that it was because of the weight of their grief. Right? Have you ever known that kind of weight? The weight of a burden pushing down on you so much?
much that your gaze can barely rise above your feet. So first, friends, the women had to look up. And when they did, again, that problem that they had expected, well, that was not the problem that they found. For the large stone that sealed the story shut had already been moved. And upon entering the tomb, the women found an even more preposterous scene. A young man in dazzling white and a tomb without a body. And as the figures of Theophanes often counsel, they are told not to fear. That Jesus, who was crucified, he has been raised. Tell his disciples, tell Peter, that he is going ahead of you to Galilee. There you will see him, just as he told you. And then, once more, we come to this conundrum that is the ending of Mark's gospel. That verse that we began with. So they went out and fled the tomb, for terror and amazement had seized them, and they said nothing to anyone, for they were afraid. Traumatized and ecstatic. And so away they ran, stunned into silence. Really? That's the way that the early church was going to provide the means to sign people up for this Jesus movement? That seems to be no way to win friends and influence people. Ending your primary narrative with terror and amazement? I mean, these other three Gospels have those amazing resurrection stories, right? Mary recognizing Jesus in the garden. The revelation in the breaking of the bread on the road to Emmaus, the gathering and the blessing on the mountain. There is none of that here. Well, so far as we can gather, that is, because depending on your Bible, you may have a couple of appendices that were added to Mark's gospel. And in those manuscripts, there are resurrection stories. You do have Mary Magdalene and those two disciples in the country. And in a new twist, Jesus upbraids the disciples for their lack of belief. But the consensus among scholars is that those endings are so different in style than the rest of this gospel that they were likely added decades and perhaps even a century later. It isn't so hard to see why they would be added. I mean, who wants to get all dressed up on a Sunday morning in your sharp and beautiful Easter clothes and hear this primal story and in terror, amazement, and silence? I mean, there will be no rides at Disneyland made from this gospel ending. Our cultural narrative is built on the happy ending. No loose strings to see here. No wrestling needed. I get it. To some degree, who doesn't want that? But that's not what Mark's gospel, at the beginning or at the end, is about. And I don't know that life is either. Now, to be sure, there have been debates carried across centuries, and some have said, and some still say, that these endings are authentic to this gospel. Others say that the real ending has been lost in the mists of time. Adding to this mystery, our Greek text actually ends with a phrase that does not often end a sentence, let alone a book. And yet, what some scholars have been pointing us to is the possibility that this was Mark's arc all along. Lamar Williamson asks us this question this Easter Sunday.
He asks, when is an ending not the end? When a dead man rises from the tomb, and when a gospel ends in the middle of a sentence. Mark's gospel, rather than rounding the arc with resurrection stories, sets the scene, leads us where to look, and then leads us to finish the story. Leads us to finish the story. That's undoubtedly why we have these so-called shorter and longer endings to Mark's gospel, right? That seem to rival the many endings of the Lord of the Rings. Each time they attempt to complete this arc for the reader, but that does not seem to be the intent of a writer of this gospel. For from the beginning to the end, Mark's gospel reads more like poetry than it does like prose. And at this pivotal moment, at this ending that is not the end, it seems that Mark is giving us the first half of the couplet, but we are left still in the verse. This last verse, then, awestruck and perhaps fearful reader, is our invitation to respond. For this Easter Sunday morning does not exist for itself. It is only the beginning of what is to come. We, like these faithful women, we all too often walk in the early morning light and only expect death in all of its forms. The pain, the destruction, the isolation, the disintegration of what it can be like to live in this world. We know what it is like to be these women coming to this tomb expecting death. We face this same question. What does it mean to live when death is not the final word? When that empty tomb comes a promise that Jesus has been raised and has gone ahead and awaits us there. For these women, for those disciples, I mean, the women must have eventually shared the story. Otherwise, we wouldn't be telling it this morning. For these earliest followers of Jesus the Christ, going back to Galilee meant being sent back into their lives, but not as they were. They were sent back into the mess of ordinary times and days to live out what Jesus had begun. Radical practices of healing, of solidarity, of sacrificial love. In this past year, All Souls has begun a relationship with some of the groups who are providing hospitality and support and solidarity with those who, in their migration to this country, have been detained by Homeland Security. As part of our ongoing relationship, a couple of our parishioners participated in what is known as the post-release accompaniment program. And so one afternoon and night, several months ago, a couple of All Souls parishioners, Elena and Sharon, accompanied a 19-year-old migrant whom we'll call Mariana. Mariana and her husband and their toddler were fleeing from their native Honduras when Mariana was apprehended at the border. After months in detention here in Richmond, she was approved for the asylum process and released on bond. But like almost all of those released as asylum seekers, she was released far, far away from family or from friends, with only the clothes on the back that she was apprehended in. But because the Interfaith Coalition for Immigrant Rights had been supporting Mariana, they knew, they had been planning for her release, and they reached out to Elena and to Sharon to accompany her. Otherwise, Mariana, like others who are released, would have had to wait for a county bus that comes every once in a while, and she would have been left there to wait without resources, without any knowledge of this area. And so, armed with a backpack prepared by All Souls that had a basic hygiene kit, pants, a zip-up jacket, a washcloth, a towel, and some snacks, Elena and Sharon met Mariana at the detention center in Richmond. They took her out for her first real meal in months, and then drove her to SFO. And after talking with Delta personnel and then with a TSA supervisor, they were able to walk with Mariana to her gate, had her call her husband in Florida to let him know that she was finally on her way. Mariana boarded her flight, and once she had arrived safely in Florida, she called back to the Bay Area, thanking all who had walked with her. Elena and Sharon, for their part, were left amazed by her courage. And you could say that all that Elena and Sharon did was to offer a backpack and a ride. But so far as I can see, they were living out this promise of the resurrection by being present with those who have been scattered and are in need. In all of the mess of the world around them, Sharon and Elena were following this resurrective arc, giving of themselves that another might come closer to wholeness. Friends, I for one am tired. I am tired of feeling trapped between, well, it has always been, and it cannot be. So often, given the gravity of the crises that erupt around us, the chaos of climate change, the vast disparity of income inequality, the willingness to see violence as the only means to an end, in all this, it can be easy to assume that terror, amazement, and silence are just the final word. That is why this arc of Mark's good news is so critical for us to hear this morning. Because this good news is not simply about a future promise of life after death, but also about our participation in this inextinguishable love in the present. It is when we reach out to those who are struggling, when we stand with those who are vulnerable, when we offer our presence, our attention, our healing to those who are being broken by a world of indifference and cruelty, this is when we too follow Jesus onto Nazareth, onto Galilee, and to beyond. What would this resurrective arc look like in this neighborhood? On this block, in this church, in this city, in this state, in this country? What would it look like in your life? This afternoon, this week, in your home, at your work, in your school. It seems to me that it might look something like what the poet Julia Esquivel reveals to us in her poem, the poem she wrote called "They Have Threatened Us with Resurrection." Esquivel lived under the military dictatorship in Guatemala. And after decades of refusing to either abandon hope or to take up arms, she escaped assassination and was forced into exile. But even in the midst of all the kidnapping and the killing and the mayhem, she wrote this poetic response, one that I believe follows this gospel arc of Mark's good news. She writes, "What keeps us from sleeping is that they have threatened us with resurrection. Because at each nightfall, though exhausted from the endless inventory of killing since 1954, yet we continue to love life and do not accept their death. Because in this marathon of hope, there are always others to relieve us in bearing the courage necessary to arrive at the goal which is beyond death. Accompany us then on this vigil, and you will know what it is to dream. You will then know how marvelous it is to live threatened with resurrection, to dream awake, to keep watch asleep, to live while dying, and to already know oneself resurrected.